Christopher Joyce just mentioned the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, whose current campaign is an effort to convince companies and governments that reducing carbon emissions can be consistent with business and economic growth. The chairman of the commission is Felipe Calderón, the former president of Mexico. He joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
One of the key recommendations of your group's report is, and I quote, a strong, lasting, and equitable international climate agreement. Isn't that exactly what everyone's figured out cannot emerge from the United Nations this year?
Well, the point is that we recommend that because that is true. It is important to have an international agreement, but this time could be different, Robert, in the sense that we created in Cancun a model in which every single country, either developed or developing countries, could offer unilateral commitments to reduce carbon emission. I think it's difficult, but feasible.
In your commission's report, the new climate economy, give us a sense, give us two key things that would have to happen for us to reduce carbon emissions.
Well, one is to phase out the fossil fuel subsidies. It is incredible that we are expending $600 billion a year on fossil fuels subsidies and less than 100 in renewable energy. That is one quite important. The other is to establish, for instance, carbon tax mechanism. Why we say that? Because if you provide these clear signals, you can end the uncertainty for business sector, and that will provide a lot of jobs and economic growth and reduce the cost of capital as long as you are reducing the uncertainty. And let me tell you, Robert, the lack of real and clear signals in public policy is killing that new investment that we are needing.
But let me make sure that I understand what you're saying. You're saying first, end the subsidies to fossil fuel production, tax preferences, government support, whatever. But then you're saying also put in place subsidies for alternative energy sources or level the playing field and have no role for government at all in that.
No, actually,
in that competition.
Actually,
which is it?
With the money that the governments will take and save phasing out the fossil fuels, we are talking about $600 billion a year. Those governments could do a lot of things, either to apply that money to education or law enforcement or providing health services to the people, or to promote renewable energy. We are not making a specific recommendation to subsidize renewable energy. It would be desirable, in my opinion. But what we are saying clearly is at least you need to invest in research and development regarding renewable energy.
How do you answer the cynical observation that it's easier for former presidents to make these recommendations than it is for sitting presidents who are also trying to make their people more prosperous, or certainly not make them less prosperous than they already feel?
That it is true, but actually I didn't act only as former president. I made a lot of things as current president of Mexico some years ago. We reduced unilaterally the carbon emissions in Mexico. Is the first country in developing world that established unilateral commitment to do that. And we started the renewable energy projects and wind energy and from scratch, from zero. So we moved the country in that sense. It is possible to do things. Now, as former president, yes, it could be easier to do that. It's my personal conviction that it is necessary to do, and that's the way I'm working really hard on this.
President Calderón, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure, Robert.
It's Felipe Calderón, a former president of Mexico, who is now the chairman of the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate.
The Baltimore Ravens today defended their handling of the domestic violence case against running back Ray Rice. Owner Steve Bisciotti denied reports that he pressed the National Football League to be lenient with Rice. Rice's case is one of a series of scandals plaguing the NFL, prompting widespread criticism. According to the league, women make up 45% of its fan base. And as NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, women are not reacting with one voice.
Judging by a recent NBC poll, the scandals are not keeping most fans from the game. At a Washington, D.C. sports bar, Atlanta native Tara Bell says she's still cheering her beloved Falcons.
I grew up watching the games. I've always been a diehard fan.
Bell agrees the players should be disciplined, but
I kind kind of look at it as, okay, they're a human, they make a mistake, but I would still support my team. Even if there was somebody on the Falcons, I would probably still support them. I do believe that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Others have been quicker to judge, at least when it comes to the league itself. Take the past week's persistent allegations that the NFL covered up a video of Baltimore Ravens player Ray Rice knocking his then-fiancée out cold in an elevator.
Hi, everyone. Baltimore Ravens player.
Comedian Megan McKay scored a YouTube hit with this searingly sarcastic video she calls a Ray Rice-inspired makeup tutorial.
So the first step, as always, is foundation. And I'm using a new shade that I just bought called the NFL. I really like this color because it'll cover up anything just to save face.
For some women, that kind of cynicism has been building for years.
Well, I first got disillusioned with football after I graduated from Notre Dame.
Erin Ryan is a news editor at Jezebel, a pop culture website for women, and she's a lifelong football fan. But in 2010, a student accused a Notre Dame football player of sexual assault after the player's friend sent text messages warning her not to mess with Notre Dame football. The woman killed herself. Ryan decided to boycott Notre Dame games. Then she started noticing regular assault allegations against NFL players. The most recent scandals?
It just reaffirmed everything that this gnawing sensation had told me. This idea that the league doesn't really care about its fans, it doesn't care about its players, it just cares about making money.
Ryan can't remember the last regular season NFL game she saw. She recently wrote a column for Jezebel with the headline, "If you care about women and still support the NFL, you are a hypocrite." For some African Americans, though, demonizing the league is not easy.
We don't want to demonize these men, whether they're black or white, because they have issues themselves. Let us help our sons.
Reverend Marcia Dyson is a victim of domestic violence and part of the Black Women's Roundtable. The group said it was outraged that all four domestic violence experts the NFL called on for help are white, even though two-thirds of the league's own players are black. Dyson says the NFL's now agreed to meet with the roundtable. She wants them to understand many young players come from broken homes, violent neighborhoods.
But you come with a lot of issues that you have not been able to address with the immediate gratification and the power that your league now gives you as a star.
Instead of banning players, Dyson wants the league to help them. And her empathy extends to NFL Commissioner Goodell.
I'd rather see him stay and become a better person because of this, honestly.
That way, she says, we just might see a real transformation. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Jason Moran's new album, All Rise, began in 2011 when he staged a dance party salute to pianist Fats Waller in Harlem, featuring singer Michelle Ndegechello. Now that party has become a touring project and a new album. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, admits to mixed feelings.
Jason Moran, putting a little extra bump in Fats Waller's handful of keys. It's from Moran's All Rise, his wildly uneven Waller tribute on Blue Note. Fats Waller was, among other talents, a two-fisted pianist who got a brilliant sound from the instrument. He could keep going for hours without exhausting his ideas or energy. Jason Moran has a knack for modernizing Waller-era material at the piano. He gets the spirit right and then tosses in gleeful anachronisms. This is 1921's The Sheik of Araby, which Fats recorded in 1938. instrumental pieces on All Rise salute Waller the pianist, who dabbled a little in electric keyboards. They take liberties with the material in his spirit. The rest of the program takes fuzzier aim at Waller the songwriter and singer. Here's how the album begins.
Put your hands on it, get that right tick and rhythm. Put your hands on it, put your hands on it, put your hands on it, get that right tick and rhythm.
You see what they did there. Slow Waller down, decontextualize him, the emotional tone changes, and he's not funny anymore. That snippet sets the tone for the vocal pieces on All Rise. Slowing Waller down, Moran, singer Michelle Endegaiocello, and their helpers do something conceptually bold, if a little unnerving. They turn Fats' rollicking tunes into smooth jazz. Since Marky Post's character sang it in the 1988 TV movie Glitz, have I heard Ain't Misbehavin' sound quite so glitzy. When Fats Waller sang, as when he played, everything had a lightness and bounce to it. He never took a song or himself too seriously. His off-the-grid moments, the shaggy sung or spoken asides, are central to his art. These slick updates smooth all that away. Listen to a bit of Waller's musical house party, The Joint is Jumpin'. Then Jason Moran's rethink.
Check your weapons at the door. Be sure to pay your quarter. Burn your leather on the floor. Grab anybody's daughter. The roof is rocking. The neighbor's knocking. We're all bums when the wagon comes. I mean the joint is jumping. Let it be. Yeah. Send this joint, boy. Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah.
Piano stomping. Dancers bumping, come on, cats, and check your hats. I mean, this joint is jumping.
I'm mindful this recording project stems from an evening of stylish entertainment, and I bet it makes for a nice evening out. But maybe you have to be there. And it's not like you need to dress Fats Waller up to make him stylish or entertaining. In the end, the vocal numbers on All Rise are really about the rhythm and bluesification of jazz that major labels and booster websites have gotten behind. Even so, I doubt Fats Waller would have minded.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed All Rise, the new album by pianist Jason Moran on the Blue Note label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Rebaldonato, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Next, we'll report on the economic effects of a health crisis. The crisis is Ebola in West Africa, and setting aside the lives lost, the cost to prosperity is devastating. Here's NPR's Jackie Northam.
The three nations hardest hit by Ebola are among the poorest on the African continent. They're emerging from years of conflict and instability, but still they've been showing steady economic progress in recent years. That's now come to a screeching halt. Last week, the World Bank reported that Ebola could deal a potential catastrophic blow to their economies. Jim Yong Kim is the bank's president.
For 2014, we estimate that the GDP losses to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea from this crisis will be a combined $360 million, which is a huge proportion of these very small economies.
Kim says there are two kinds of contagion surrounding Ebola. One is the virus itself. The second is fear about its rapid spread. It's that fear that forced the cancellation of many airlines into the Ebola-stricken countries. International companies have pulled workers out of the region, and projects in some key sectors such as mining are suspended. Manufacturing and construction are also being hit, says John Panzer, an economist with the World Bank.
We're seeing cement sales, for example, that are leading to construction drop by 60%. We're seeing fuel sales in Liberia reduced by 35% only in the month of August.
The Ebola scare is clearly seen in the agricultural sector. Roughly half the populations of Liberia and Sierra Leone work on cocoa and peanut plantations, rice and cassava farms. Georgia Beans is the project director in Sierra Leone for ACDI VOCA, an international development group that works with farmers. She says many farmers have fled in fear.
Is it fear of going out and contracting Ebola? Is it fear of investing your assets when you don't know what's going to happen in the future? Do you want to buy seed? Maybe you don't. Maybe you feel you need to hold on to your assets and your resources.
Fear has also forced many surrounding countries to seal their borders, normally where much trade is done. That includes the Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire, which produces nearly 40% of the world's cocoa. Analysts say there would be a huge impact on the world's cocoa industry if the farms had to be abandoned. Liberia has a small cocoa industry, but usually many Liberians head to Côte d'Ivoire to help with the upcoming harvest. Not this year.
Precautions have been set up to make sure that the virus does not spread into Côte d'Ivoire.
Bill Guyton is the president of the World Cocoa Foundation. He says the government in Côte d'Ivoire needed to seal its borders to make sure not one person with Ebola gets onto the cocoa farms.
There are millions of farmers that grow the crop in West Africa. These are small-scale family farms. Many of them are in remote areas. So it is a challenge both to communicate and to reach out to these farmers.
The International Risk Consultancy Group, IHS, says so far the Ebola epidemic has not had a major effect on economic activity outside Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. But it's tenuous. The World Bank says if cases start showing up in surrounding countries, the economic cost could be in the billions of dollars. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The writer Jeff Hobbs had a roommate at Yale University.
He considered him his best friend, a student from New Jersey with a poetic name, Robert Peace.
He was funny and very bright, smiled a lot, which is not to say he was totally agreeable because he had opinions. And, you know, if he disagreed with you or thought you were acting like an idiot, he would certainly let you know it. But he would also tell you if he was proud of you, which is very rare for a man, and particularly a young man.
Robert Peace was a great student with tremendous potential. He also sold marijuana in college. After graduation, he returned to his hometown, eventually to teach high school.
9 years after that graduation, in 2011, Jeff Hobbs got the news. His former roommate had been murdered, shot while dealing drugs just outside Newark, New Jersey. The shooting drove Hobbs to make sense, if he could, of what happened to his friend. His interviews with the roommate's family turned into a book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. And you hear the emotion in Hobbs' voice as he describes what he found. Peace was African-American, born to a working single mom in a tough neighborhood during the crack epidemic of the 80s.
He didn't talk much about that. You know, over time, I began to understand that he did not come from abject poverty. His family owned the home he grew up in. But there were very little means, and I knew that his father was in prison, Rob said, for manslaughter. In fact, it was for the murder of two women when Rob was 7 years old. He was imprisoned for life.
It's clear you spent a lot of time with Robert Peace's mother, Jackie. What is she like?
You know, I could go on and on about Jackie. I think she's the only perfect person in this story. She was a working mother. She worked very hard, and then she came home and spent as much time with her son as possible, and she took him to the library, took him to the park. When he was about three in daycare, the lady there told Jackie they were calling him the professor, and she thought they were making fun of her, or worse, they were making fun of her son, before she realized that they were calling him that earnestly in reference to his intelligence and curiosity.
Hmm. Now, how did it affect Robert Peace, still well under the age of 10, when his father was arrested for a double murder and eventually, after a long delay, put on trial and convicted?
You know, the father-son bond is big stuff, of course, and particularly here, Rob really revered his father, who was sort of the mayor of the neighborhood, as I gathered, had a kind word to say about everyone. They would leave the house and go eat full meals at seven different friends' houses over the course of the day, and he was very active in Rob's academic life, drilled him with good penmanship, the importance of memory, and continued to do so from prison, you know, using the prison phones once or twice a week.
I wonder if I could get you to read from page 57 a passage that describes the way that Robert Peace behaved after his father went away.
Sure. Despite the attachment he felt to his father, Rob came to scorn abandonment above all things, and as he turned 11 and fifth grade began, he aggressively assumed the role of husband to his mother. She would find dinner plates covered with foil in the fridge when she got home late, leftovers of whatever Rob had cooked for himself that night. Sometimes she would wake up around midnight after a few hours' sleep, and he would be in the rocking chair beside her bed reading. He began working odd jobs on weekends for people he knew through his father, raking leaves, shoveling snow, painting, for a few dollars per gig. Always he divided these earnings and left half on the counter for his mother. If he made $6.50 over a weekend of helping move furniture, and his employer gave him an extra 15 cents for a candy bar on the way home, Rob factored the tip into his wages, rounded up 1 cent, and left $3.33 for Jackie.
Mm. That rounded up cent.
Yeah.
Did this experience somehow make him a better person?
It's really hard to say. Life is so messy. I think it made him a leader. And also, I think that experience really built his incredible capacity for friendship, particularly with friends in his school and around his neighborhood, many of whom shared this plight of fatherlessness.
Did that difficult experience also contain the seeds of his eventual downfall?
Perhaps in that, you know, it really soldered his attachment to his neighborhood. You know, he went to Yale and then he came back. But that's a bigger question. You know, why does the country seem to demand that if you come from a certain socioeconomic level, in order to succeed, you have to leave your home behind? You know, he came back from Yale and he taught high school, other young men like himself, many of them from broken homes, and he was really great at that.
And that side of him was inspiring, but then there was the other side that was involved with drug gangs.
He was never involved with gangs. He placed himself in that that particular orbit where violence is not uncommon. Also, you know, he liked the feeling of being the man, I think, be his own boss, I suppose.
Did you ask yourself, after you learned that he had been killed as part of a drug deal, whether anything could have changed his course?
I did, and, you know, there is the question in this book, in this story, about whether you can save people. I'm sure that Rob asked himself that same question. He worked most of his life to try to free his father from prison, you know, try to pull his friends sort of forward in life along with him. And I think he probably decided near the end that you can't really save people.
What made you want to figure out the life of this man you had known who had been killed in this way?
you know, I was brushing my teeth next to my wife when I learned he had died violently and pointlessly, you know, a mile from where he'd grown up. And the funeral, 400 people, you know, very painful, also beautiful, people from all over the world in downtown Newark. But outside that church, it seemed like a lot of people were almost eagerly condemning him as this cliche of potential squandered. You know, it was just, we were there, it was sort of a reunion aspect to it with mutual friends, and, you know, we just knew he wasn't. Rob Peace was not a cliche. We write about what conflicts us, whatever medium, and nothing's ever conflicted me more than this loss.
Jeff Hobbs is the author of The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
It's NPR News.